Welcome back. Last time I talked about the Uruk period in southern Mesopotamia particularly, but more generally across Mesopotamia, with the expansion of this extraordinary Uruk trading network that, in a sense, prefigured the sort of modern economic exchange systems, the kind of international economic relationships that we see across the world today. The Uruk period ends in Mesopotamia at approximately 3000 BC. And the early dynastic period, and there's a significant term, begins around 2900 BC. The intervening century is sometimes called the Jemdet Nasser period, after a site of that name in southern Iraq. But in fact, what we see is broad cultural continuity through the Uruk, Jemdet Nasser, and beginning of the early dynastic period. The early dynastic period in Mesopotamia lasted until approximately 2400 BC. The early dynastic period is especially associated with that group of people who we know as the Sumerians. Culturally and linguistically, it seems that Sumerian populations were dominant in at least southern Mesopotamia during the Ubaid and Uruk periods as well. But they enter history as a named people in written sources only with the spread of cuneiform writing during the 3rd millennium BC. Now, the Sumerian language can be read, but it is, as far as we know, related to no other known language. Now, one might ask how this could be. How, on the one hand, can we read Sumerian writings, but at the same time say that this language is not related to any other known language on Earth? Well, the issue is here that even to a greater extent than in Egypt, 3rd millennium BC Mesopotamia was a multilingual and multi-ethnic society, or group of communities, or group of city-states. And so we have texts from the 3rd millennium BC, particularly from the late 3rd millennium BC, that are in both Sumerian and a variety of other languages that we know far more about. So Sumerian, then, is what linguists call a linguistic isolate. Of course, that doesn't mean that there weren't other related languages being spoken at that time that we just haven't yet discovered or that perhaps weren't written down. It simply means that we cannot make direct, clear relationships between the Sumerian language as it exists and other languages. There's lots of speculations about modern languages that Sumerian may be related to. And these include, for example, languages of the Dravidian family. Now that's interesting because the Dravidian languages are possibly associated with the Harappan civilization of the Indus Valley that I'll talk about in later lectures, and that, in fact, was contemporary with Sumerian civilization in Mesopotamia. Now, that relationship is hypothetical. It's by no means well established. There's a great deal of linguistic debate about this issue, but it's still significant. It's still important. Sumerian was succeeded in Mesopotamia in the late 3rd millennium BC by a variety of Semitic languages. It appears for some reason that during this time period that Semitic languages became more prestigious, more widely accepted. Perhaps Semitic-speaking communities were economically or politically more successful. But in any case, gradually through time, Sumerian disappeared. Sumerian southern Mesopotamia during the early dynastic period was a culture of city-states with both political, ideological, and cultural identity centered on the city. In that we see generally a good deal of continuity from the Uruk period. We can really look back from the early dynastic into the Uruk period and see the roots of the political systems, the social systems, the cultural systems that further develop during the early dynastic period. Now, during this time, there were approximately 12 major cities in southern and central Mesopotamia, along with perhaps 20 or 30 smaller centers. Most of these urban centers had already been occupied for centuries or millennia. Eridu, which I've mentioned, Uruk, Warka, which I've mentioned, Ur, Larsa, Nippur, Akkad, Sippar, Kish, and others. These cities existed at the top of a multi-level settlement hierarchy. For the most part, a three-level settlement hierarchy. Each of these cities was surrounded by smaller towns, each of which in turn was surrounded by rural hamlets and villages. By the end of the early dynastic period, there were approximately 50,000 people living in Uruk, a population far larger than that of any urban center on Earth until that time. If you remember, during the late Uruk period itself, the population of Uruk was about 20,000. So it expanded considerably during the early dynastic period. There is abundant early dynastic evidence for cultural differences in language, for example, between different city-states. In addition, the territories of different states frequently housed members of a number of different ethnic groups. As I noted, Mesopotamia was a multi-ethnic, multilinguistic region right from the very beginning, in contrast, as we're going to see, to, for example, the Nile Valley and classical Egypt. It's not surprising, I suppose, given all of the cultural influences and intersections that still exist at the junction of the Tigris and Euphrates River in modern Iraq and Iran, that we would see this degree of multiculturalism. It's in this sense, I think, that we can talk about a Mesopotamian civilization. And here I want to make this distinction between political systems on the one hand, the constellation of independent Mesopotamian city-states of the early dynastic period, and an overarching Mesopotamian civilization, a more or less common set of ideas and practices, a widespread set of assumptions about how the world worked, or at least how the world should work, a set of shared practices and institutions across a major part of the Near East. This Mesopotamian civilization was by no means homogeneous. It was probably far more widely shared among urban elites than among common and rural people. As I've said, these widespread distributions of cultural systems seemed to often be more widely shared among elites than common people. Its edges, the edges of the Mesopotamian civilization, were no doubt hard to discern. There was no fixed boundaries here, but it certainly did exist. Evidence of centralized rule in these early dynastic city-states is abundant, both because of the spread of writing and simply because such rule was becoming far more elaborated than had been the case in earlier periods. Rulers were not being shy about their own role within society. Once writing is developed and disseminated, rulers, of course, begin talking about themselves in very positive terms. And they begin demonstrating their power, their majesty, their role, their connection with the gods more and more clearly. Temples continue to play a central role in Mesopotamian ideological and economic life. Here you see, for example, an image of the ziggurat at Ur, an elaboration of the notion of worship and of the temple. And essentially a ziggurat, this famous term, possibly represented in the Bible as the Tower of Babel. A ziggurat is an artificial mound, perhaps an artificial mountain, upon which one would set a temple to bring it closer to the heavens. And so the mobilization of labor that one would need in order to create this, the wealth that would be required to build this new form of temple on top of these platforms, on top of these artificial mountains, was significant. Equally significant, however, is the emergence of secular rather than religious rule during the early dynastic period, seen in the person of the king, the lugal, or en, or ensi in Sumerian. These seem to be synonyms of various sorts for ruler, constantly depicted in Sumerian art and iconography. Kingship is also expressed in the building of palaces in urban centers that are significantly more elaborate than are any earlier palaces during the Uruk period. And by the end of the period, at least, by the end of the early dynastic, in the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, in the construction of royal tombs, which are best known from the city of Ur. What I want to note here is the amount of labor, the amount of effort demonstrated in these royal tombs, the human sacrifice that was involved, the wealth and delicacy of the grave goods. This is a real kingly burial, and I'll come back to this in a moment. So secular rule then involved a progressive separation of the political and religious spheres during the early dynastic, although religion remained a vital underpinning of state legitimacy, as of course it does in later periods. Political organization, rule, the sway of the king, is during this time, though, still centered in the individual urban city-states. There's no wider political unification across southern or central Mesopotamia beyond periodic, loose, and temporary alliances. At the same time, there seems to have been a good deal of agreement among the populations of these city-states, not merely the elites, but among the populations more generally, about how rule should work, what the characteristics of a ruler should be, how rule was to be justified religiously and ideologically. Economic arrangements, writing, religious systems, even a divine pantheon are widely shared between the Mesopotamian cities. If we see references to gods and goddesses in different Mesopotamian cities, there's great continuity, great commonality from one to the other. Now, what this also involved usually, as was the case, for example, in classical Greece, was a situation in which particular rulers, particular gods, would be associated with particular cities. There would be a close relationship between the legitimacy of the ruler and the favor of a god or goddess who was concerned with a particular urban center. So we can speak of a cultural area, as I said, that can be described as a Mesopotamian civilization, even if political rule was situated at a much more local level. There's good evidence during the early dynastic period for massive stratification of wealth and power in these city-states. You'll remember when I was speaking of earlier times of Halathian, Samaran, Ubayid communities in the same region. One of the things I was talking about was the challenge for archaeologists of teasing out, of distinguishing when degrees of stratification of wealth and power actually existed. Well, in the early dynastic period, we don't have to worry about that anymore. People in these Mesopotamian urban centers are making this very obvious for us. We can measure this through variation, variability in architecture and household goods. The spatial arrangement of households with larger, richer dwellings situated at the centers of cities near the temples and palaces. And with the wealth of elite households, particularly as displayed in grave goods. Rulers and members of the elite during the early dynastic period were burying a great deal of their predecessors' wealth, and in doing so, displaying their own wealth and power. This may seem like an extremely strange practice to us. Why would one take beautiful, valuable objects and bury them with a ruler, with a nobleman, with an ancestor? But we have to remember that we live in a society where mechanisms for the storage of wealth through generations are well established, whereas that was not necessarily the case in the past, and certainly in the early dynastic period. In such circumstances, it may well have made sense for people living in these Mesopotamian city-states to, if you like, invest in present-day prestige rather than the possibility, the uncertainty, of future conservation of wealth. Perhaps the relevant modern comparison for us is not with funerals, that is, we should not necessarily be comparing early dynastic funerals to modern funerals in, for example, North American society, but let's take weddings. Modern weddings. There's no economic reason for the huge, fancy, expensive weddings that we see in the society pages of newspapers today. People can and do get married much more cheaply and much more simply. What do big weddings, big expensive weddings, do for us? Well, what they do is they demonstrate very visibly our wealth and our status. And they send an unmistakable message to our relations, to our friends, and to our neighbors about both how much we love our families and our traditions, and how much we can afford to spend in a few days of celebration of a new marriage. In Mesopotamia, we know relatively little about weddings, but we do know archaeologically that the rulers threw great funerals, except for the servants. In the royal tombs at Ur, servants and retainers accompanied a dead ruler into the afterlife. And here you see illustrations, a set of reconstructions for the 1920s of the situation when one of these rulers of Ur was being buried. An exceptionally striking illustration of the difference in status between ruler and subject. Human sacrifice associated with the death of the ruler. This can be seen as a way of increasing the personal prestige of the successor to the person who has died, as is known from ethnographic and historical sources. The issue here is that the ruler, and thus the successor to the ruler, is so different, is a being of such different qualities from common people, that one can have those common people, your servants, your retainers, your slaves, accompany you into death. We're going to see in a variety of areas of the world that human sacrifice in association with the burial of rulers is a not uncommon circumstance, but it's interestingly enough a circumstance that tends to disappear as the political institutions of the state become better developed. We may think that when secular power becomes really entrenched, elites may not have needed such dazzling displays of wealth and power and power over life any longer. That probably would have been significantly a relief to their servants. There's much more evidence for fortifications and militarization during the early dynastic period. The Sumerian city-states were in competition with one another, and that competition very frequently involved warfare. Here we see a famous artifact, the Standard of Ur, a panel, a two-sided panel, that depicts war and peace as two forms of life. So these city-states in southern Mesopotamia during this period, they're not coexisting peaceably. There's an immense amount of conflict and struggle going on. Perhaps peace, as on the Standard of Ur, is in a sense idealized, but it was not necessarily the normal state of affairs. And we're going to see similar circumstances when, for example, we look at Maya city-states in Mesoamerica toward the end of the course. A variety of coexisting, highly centralized political units at short distances from one another seems to be a recipe for high degrees of conflict. One extraordinary phenomenon of the early dynastic period was what's known as hyperurbanism. At the beginning of the early dynastic period, farmers began to abandon rural areas and congregate in the cities. At its height, this phenomenon of hyperurbanism resulted in the near abandonment of small rural communities and the settlement of well over 50% of the population in urban areas. At the same time, the great majority of these people remained farmers, which of course implies that they then had to travel very long distances each day to get to their fields. When you think about a situation in which people actually have to abandon their farms, move into towns, and then walk, in some cases, 10 or 20 kilometers to work their fields every day, and then come back. This is a fairly significant development. It's a very different form of urbanism from the kinds of urbanism that we know today, for example, where most people live in urban areas, 80% approximately in the United States today, but relatively few of those people work in rural areas. We have very small proportions of our population today that are actually farmers. And we would have to imagine that in many ways this would be an extremely inefficient economic system. So in a sense, what we're looking at with this system of hyperurbanism, then this process of hyperurbanism, is a decline in at least that element of the efficiency of Mesopotamian agricultural systems. What would cause this? This phenomenon may in fact have been caused by the general levels of conflicts between Mesopotamian city-states. The amount of warfare going on at different times between these independent political units, with the attendant dangers to people not sheltered behind city walls. What we have to remember here is that these city-states are not large units geographically. We're not talking about vast territories here. And in fact, this restricted spatial extent, the relatively small size of Mesopotamian city-states, is an important characteristic that in later lectures we're going to contrast with contemporary cities, states in other parts of the world, for example, in Egypt. So it's likely that the fact that not merely were these city-states in conflict, but they were in conflict at short distances, made hyperurbanism, the evacuation of rural areas, and the movement of people into towns necessary. Of course, when one thinks of it, this would not have protected crops in the fields, herds of animals, and so on. It's likely that hyperurbanism as well was encouraged by the general attraction of cities and the social and economic opportunities that the cities brought. We have to think about urbanization in the same way as it has happened in other parts of the world, as the establishment of urban centers that are attractive to people who move into them. That's one of the main ways in which these urban centers increase in population. So some component of hyperurbanism was probably the natural attraction of cities for rural people. That country mouse who wants to become a city mouse, I mentioned last time. It's probably as well convenient for elites to be able to increase their control over the population by concentrating them in urban areas. But it's likely in general that conflict, military conflict, warfare between Mesopotamian city-states was the primary mover behind hyperurbanism. This period, the early dynastic period, is often known as the dawn of history. Archaeologists don't usually call it that, but it's a common term. It's with the early dynastic period that written documentation becomes more generally available. Most of it records aspects of administration and accounting. But by the end of the period, by the late 3rd millennium BC, we find virtually every type of written work, except perhaps novels, in existence in various places. During this early dynastic period, political power was then relatively fragmented between the Sumerian city-states, but this is soon going to change as rulers in different city-states tried to conquer their neighbors and unify larger areas. The first very successful ruler to attempt this was Sargon of the city of Akkad in about 2350 BC. Sargon founded a state that ruled Mesopotamia for about a century. He was followed by a succession of states and rulers, including Babylon under Hammurabi and his successors, and the Assyrian Empire in later times. However, unstable rule, political fissioning, remained characteristic of Mesopotamia, especially in earlier periods when bureaucratic and military systems were not yet fully developed. As we're going to see, this is not necessarily the case everywhere. Contemporary Egypt, for example, is going to provide us with an interesting contrast. For my next lecture, I want to examine relationships between these settled, urban, centralized, hierarchical city-states and the very different populations that dwelt away from the rivers and the fields of agricultural southern Mesopotamia, pastoral populations, herders of sheep and goats and cattle, and the role that these pastoralists would play in both the histories and the imaginations of more settled people in Mesopotamia. Thank you.